You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, a weekly series that brings you exclusive, in-depth conversations with some of the most interesting and exciting figures in hip-hop. We're brought to you by RapGenius.com, your source on the internet for decoding, annotating, and analyzing rap lyrics. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we talk to two of our favorites here on Outside the Lines, Pharoah Monch and Jean Grey, about their exciting new projects. We start with a song-by-song preview of Pharoah's upcoming new album, PTSD, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. We heard a preview of the record, which will be released in late October, and it's a really special work. We're honored to bring you what is so far Pharoah's only in-depth chat about these songs. In the second half of our show, we talk to the amazing Jean Grey about her new single, Killscreen, a.k.a. Steve Wiebe, and her upcoming Gotham Down album. But first, here's Pharoah. We met with him at the Rap Genius office in Brooklyn shortly after hearing the PTSD album in its entirety for the first time. We began by asking about the album's first track and lead single, Damage.
To the Rap Genius headquarters.
What's good, man? It's been a long time now.
So, you have PTSD, the new EP.
Yes, yeah.
And I wanted to go through it song by song and get some of your thoughts and impressions and
cool.
Talk about each one. We're going to start with Damage, which that's the third song in a trilogy, right?
Right. First song from the personification of a bullet was Straight Bullet, Organized Confusion, Big Up Prince Poe. And then the second installment was When the Gun Draws on Desire. Big up Mr. Porter, who blessed me with that track. And the last and final installment was produced by legendary Lee Stone of Internal Affairs fame, and really got in with me and made Internal Affairs what it was, and we return back to some of that sound with the Damage record.
Yeah, so that tune, there was a bunch of stuff in there that grabbed me. One of them was a wordplay or pun or something that, I don't even want to say pun because in context it's not really funny, but it's very grabbing, was the sort of wordplay around fill in the blanks.
Okay. Well, you know, it's just really simple. It's not that deep. It's just a play on, you know, blanks, guns, bullets, and, you know, if you're fucking stupid, then catch up, you know what I mean?
Like,
right. Fill in the blanks, you know. It's self-explanatory, kind
of. Yeah. And in the second verse of that tune, when we talked about it off camera last time, you mentioned that you kind of went back to the second verse after the Batman incident, and it sort of made you rethink the character in there a little bit and how
right.
well you were able to get into character.
The song was laid way before that incident, which kind of threw me for a loop, because in a lot of my songs I try to embody different characters. And this dude, like I said, in the verse, I'm sort of certified, fortified, live. You know, like, it's not a dude, actually. The bullet is crazy in this incident, not just really going wild and not really caring what is happening. It's like a frenzy at that point. And that's what threw me for a loop with the tragic incident that happened with the Dark Knight situation. So I went back and examined that character and, you know, was looking at dude on TV like, you know, that's where you have to, the mindset that you have to be in, I guess, to just be that psychotic, you know?
Cool. Now, in that tune and also in PTSD, musically, and in terms of some of the, in PTSD, especially the vocal melodies and the words in the chorus and the music and Damage, I heard a kind of 60s, 70s prog thing, a little bit of early 70s Pink Floyd, a little bit of King Crimson, not overtly, not in terms of references, but in terms of feel and mm-hmm. sound.
Yeah. Stuff like that. I mean, just being a fan of that era of music, Pink Floyd, King Crimson, Led Zeppelin, and, you know, just classic rock, Europe and here in the United States. During that era, from what I can remember seeing in terms of drug use and heroin use and Jimmy and Purple Haze, there was a certain sound and a vocal tone that was, you know, kind of psychedelic and trippy. And so I tried to capture that on the songs where I'm contemplating suicide or we're talking about heroin use.
Yeah, definitely. PTSD, speaking of songs contemplating suicide, there's a lot in there. There's, you know, obviously the whole concept of the album is a continuation of the war metaphor, right?
Right.
From your previous record.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, what better way to follow up an album called War, which is We Are Renegade, which talked about similar struggles. And now I feel like after I fought that struggle by doing my first independent release, I could talk to people about where I am socially, mentally, and emotionally with, you know, fighting this battle against the machine and still in these same situations that I speak about on the War album. The War album was like, I'm going to battle against the machine. I'm doing this independently. I'm speaking about, I'm putting out some things out there that I learned that I'm going to expose about the music industry with the Hitman. And then this is the result of me doing that, where I am emotionally now. Similar to how someone comes back from war and they're stricken by, you know, readjusting to regular situation.
Yeah, you mentioned on the title track, you talk about, oh, it's been 4 years between records and what a struggle that was.
Right. And in that point, between Internal Affairs,
yeah,
and Desire, which is where that song is taken from,
yeah,
it was a huge struggle. That's why Desire, to many people's surprise, was really an inspirational, triumphant, uplifting record, because a lot of people was in my corner. But that was like, you know, being locked into a label situation, and same thing that Lupe was saying, like, you know, started wanting to control more of what you were recording. I mean, for artists, man, that's just like death sentence.
Yeah.
You know, I was at my lowest lows, even though touring and budget and, you know, writer's deal and publishing deal, and I wasn't financially struggling at all. I was just like, I just want to create the way I want to create. And I was like, you know, tied into all of these label situations and all of these legal shit. That,
say your album literally taken out of stores.
Right. And that album got taken out of stores, and then moving from the next label situation was just tremendous. tumultuous and sickening. So I kind of pull from that emotion on the post-traumatic stress disorder song.
Musically, there's a lot happening on this record. Like I said, the prog thing happening, and even Damage has several sections, instrumental sections, including that gospel-sounding coda at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff is structured. It seems like there are a lot of live instruments, more so than on a lot of hip-hop records.
Yeah, we listen to this one song over and over and over, and we were going to sample it, and then we were like, yo, we know the cats that are really have the musicianship and knowledge to like redo this record, you know?
Yeah.
Re-get the feel, not just play it over, but just like interpret that feel and then go back in and make it sound like a sample.
Yeah, and then the musicians on this
Mike Ciro, thank you.
Yeah.
The guitarist extraordinaire played on Damage.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So you had characterized, you know, at least Broken Again and maybe the whole record as a breakup album. Right? Was that...
Yeah. So, again... I'm trying to write this film, so to speak. In my mind, I'm a director. That's the next movement. I keep telling people that. But this guy comes back from the war, as we've seen in so many films, and his girl is just like, she couldn't wait. He kept, you know, having to go back and, you know. And so this is a story about that love lost. But I metaphor it to heroin the whole way through. So it's pretty interesting. It's a beautiful song, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a horror story as well.
Yeah, it's... And you even... sang, we were talking about a second ago, even sang the hook slow and dreamy and behind the beat to kind of, I guess, give the impression of a heroin high. Was that the idea? Yeah.
Yeah, this guy is, he's going through it.
Yeah.
And so as you listen to the record, I want you to kind of understand that Damage is what he's seeing, you know.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, it's me rapping as the personification of a bullet, but the gore of that record plays into post-traumatic stress disorder. And then the jungle is the environment he comes back to. The Broken Again song is, you know, something he's dealing with in relationship, and then PTSD, post-traumatic title track, where I'm talking myself out of suicidal situation is basically that whole run of music.
Right, and that's both what's happening to the character and you drawing on stuff from your own life and getting out of the deal with
that
label.
Yeah, I don't want to get into how realistic that is. I don't...
Yeah, of course.
I don't want to cry. I'm a rap genius.
Yeah. Nice. Very, very specifically about Broken Again, two quick things. First, you either directly state or allude to a bunch of, or at least a couple of celebrity figures with their own drug issues
mm-hmm.
on that tune to kind of set the scene. There's the Richard Pryor
mm-hmm.
line,
mm-hmm.
and then there's an allusion to Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah. The interesting thing about Rap Genius to me is seeing how long it takes people or their interpretation of the lyrics. And it's super dense, especially that stanza right before the Richard Pryor line. And it's purposefully put there to be dense, a long line of things. And I just feel like I'm giving it away if I tell you what the metaphors are there.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, definitely. And the other thing about that song was another wordplay thing that really really caught my ear was the pun on CCs of solution,
right?
And CC is a carbon copy, and 7 C's and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? I guess just at this point, that kind of wordplay is so much a natural part of your style that it's not like it gets in the way of telling a story, right? It just kind of
I did a little bit of research with that, thanks to the internet. Prior to the internet, I guess I just would have went to the library because I'm not on heroin. I never used it. I didn't know exactly how many cc's of it would be correct to say in the song.
Yeah.
So I did the research, and I knew that I wanted to flip or, you know, the syringe and cc's, and then cc'd all my friends, and then because I needed them to see how beautiful it is when I'm high or when I'm with this girl. But my friends told me that she's not the one for you.
And the most kind of straightforwardly hip-hop song on it is The Jungle, just in terms of sound, anyway. You know, and it's a really just that extended metaphor of the city as jungle, and in each part of it and each group of people as a different aspect of the jungle really goes through the whole tune.
Mm-hmm. I love that record. That record I recorded originally with Lee Stone for, I believe, Desire. And we had like James Brown and Jungle Sounds, and it was out there. It was more of like,
oh, that like
funky,
in the Jungle Brothers,
right?
Sample.
It was more of like a funky thing, and the way we flipped it was crazy. And then I wound up saying some of those lyrics on a mixtape, and then when I heard this Marco Polo track, I was like, yo, this is it. This is the soundscape for the city. This is so Queens. This is so Queens. This is 40 PJs. This is Baisley. This is Southside. This is Left Rack. This is, you know, Queensbridge, Jamaica Ave. I gotta have this. So we reinterpreted the lyrics and the feel, and I'm just, that's my joint right there.
Yeah, definitely. And even at the end, you kind of take it from, you know, you start with Queens and then kind of extend the vision to all of New York, you know, sort of borough by borough, Harlem, and et cetera. And then by the end, it's this whole kind of Pan-African thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Why go there?
Because, because Ghana and Cape Town and Joburg have been showing me so much love with the War album, and most of my followers on Twitter, a lot of my followers on Twitter are from South Africa, and it correlates. We in the States, a lot of people are detached. But until you actually go, you don't really see how connected and, you know, what's on the TV over there is what's on the TV over here. And their temperament and their education for what real hip-hop is mind-boggling to me, because you would think that they would be so inundated with bullshit that they would be blinded, but it's not like that. And that's like that abroad in a lot of places as well. It's like, because art and because culture is still there and they're still proud and strong in their culture, they detect when something doesn't come from the heart, from the cultural standpoint, and it's just flimsy. So I guess it's just like...
And you think we've kind of lost that here a little bit.
Yeah, this is some rap in New York.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. That tune also has this really great little sequence where you're kind of looking back on the 80s and shouting out, you know, any number of pop culture things that definitely made me kind of crack up. Those good TV shows and commercials and wine coolers and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It took like 8 wine coolers to get a nice buzz, you know? We were bugging back then. And then we would take the wine coolers and put them in the 40. And then we would take Hawaiian Punch and put it in the 40 and try to make wine coolers out of...
Curious told me that a few days ago. He said the deal of like drinking half the 40 really quick and then pouring in Hawaiian Punch.
You empty it to the label, top of the 40 label, and then you fill it back up with a wine punch. And the fruit toast plus the beer.
When was the last time you did that?
It's been a minute. And then Guinness and OE was called an 8-ball. Yeah. But that's old school shit.
Yeah. Nice. That same song, The Jungle, I wanted you, maybe if you felt comfortable about it, I feel like the very last line in that was so powerful and I think so emblematic of what you're trying to do with this record. You say you're trying to, you know, you say, use my power to shine my light.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, maybe you could sort of comment on that for a
second. I think it goes back to a line that I said, you know, I know it's hard sometimes and we all feel fenced in, but utilize your mind to define dimensions. And it's the same thing. It's like the matrix still what you perceive. So wealth and happiness can definitely be obtained and achieved within the constraints of the song and the constraints of the city and jungle.
Awesome. And the final song in there that we haven't yet talked about is, I hesitate to even call it a remix of Grand Illusion off of the War album. It's, the lyrics are the same, but everything about it is different, including the vocal take. Why go to those lengths to remix a tune rather than just handing someone the acapellas and saying, you know, see you in 4 days?
I changed a little tiny things here and there lyrically.
Yeah.
But for the most part, in terms of the pocket of my ROM pocket, I want it to be kind of in and out because the song is so trippy.
Yeah.
And the drums are played behind, and I want it to feel like that as well. So I didn't want to just take the acapella and place it on there. I wanted to play with my flow a little bit more.
Excellent. And the beat itself is really odd. It moves in and out of being dissonant, you know what I mean, of being almost uncomfortable to listen to at points and building up a lot of tension before releasing it. Did you give the folks who played on it, did you say, I want that kind of approach where it's like flowing and uncomfortable, or did they come up with that?
They came up with that themselves. Step Kids.
Yeah.
My man Jeff, I just told him, you know, do what you guys do. I'm a fan of the band, and you know, again, when I got it back, I loved it. And it's a challenge. I think it's important because it's not traditional, you know, it's not kick, snare, kick, kick, snare, 8 timing hi-hat with an 808, you know.
Right, which doesn't provide anyone, I don't think it provides you many challenges at this point.
You could rock that too, but, you know, that's not what this is. And that's coming, you know, that's coming, but this is post-traumatic stress disorder, so in every sense of the word, I can't just tell you that this is what I'm trying to have you feel and then, you know, just have beats.
Right.
You know, this is like
was it,
more
was it,
feel.
Was it a challenge for you to write more of this almost in kind of a pop song format where you have, you know, live instruments and sung choruses and hooks that are a little more impressionistic rather than like this is the title of the song kind of hook? Was it tough for you to move into that mode of thinking and writing?
Not at all. I mean, that comes easy for me as well because I'm just a fan of that stuff, and that's where my heart took me on this project. I want you to know, want the listener to know that I'm pouring my heart out, and I felt it would be more significant to sing the pour than to rap the, you know, rap it. And like Damage is purposeful, you know, it's like that chorus is purposeful and The Jungle is purposeful. I just feel like PTSD and Broken Again is just as purposeful.
Well, I can't wait for people to hear the finished product. Thanks for
coming
by.
Thank you again. I appreciate it. See, I'm always glad to come through and play music. I stand by the music.
We'll be right back with our conversation with Gene Gray. You're listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. If you're curious about any of the songs mentioned on this show, you can find lyrics, music, and annotations on rapgenius.com. You can also see both Pharaoh and Gene's verified Rap Genius accounts by clicking on the Verified Artists tab at rapgenius.com. Welcome back to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. In the second half of today's show, we bring back our show's very first guest, Gene Gray. Gene's new single, Killscreen, a.k.a. Steve Wiebe, is in part a tribute to Wiebe, who is a champion Donkey Kong player, featured in the 2007 documentary The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters. In tribute to the song's inspiration, we talked to Gene about it while she was playing Donkey Kong, which is the source of the background music and occasional exclamations you'll hear during our talk. We began by asking her what connection she felt to the video gamers featured in The King of Kong.
So, I'm here with Gene Gray, who couldn't tear herself away from playing Donkey Kong long enough, so I'm going to ask her questions and try to distract her. I'm talking about the new screen song, Killscreen, a.k.a. Steve Wiebe.
Wiebe Clevin.
Ah. Can you talk a little bit about him and the King of Kong movie and kind of
what
grabbed you about it?
When he asked me questions.
Yeah.
So thanks.
What about the movie and him grabbed you?
Number one, I'm fascinated by anything 80s. And, you know, clearly because I'm not an 80s baby or a 90s baby, I guess, which is more popular now, which is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it's a nice kind of return to everything, and I was fascinated with Billy Mitchell because he's like the perfect 80s villain. Even if it was just a fucking karate movie, I would want to see him with that hair and just being a complete dick. And Steve was the good guy, you know, you wanted him to win. And if it was a movie, just not an actual life, it couldn't have been written any better. And his you could possibly say it was obsessiveness, but it was still dedication and passion, and he wasn't douchey about it.
Right.
And the, you know, the clear line between him and Billy was great. And, you know, you had a villain and you had a hero.
Makes sense. And the kill screen
aspect, right? The kill screen is the part of the game that is unplayable due to programming oversight.
Yeah, not level one.
Right, not level one.
No.
Basically, the programmers never expected anyone to get that far.
Right.
Right, which... So what does that concept mean to you in terms of, like, your art, your career? Like, what grabbed you about the kill screen idea?
I think the entire sentence, the, you know, programmers never expected me to get this far. I think that, you know, it's been a long time. It's been since 96, 97.
Yeah.
And it was either, you know, even a lot of people still being like, where's Jean? I don't know. She hasn't put out any new music. But I never stopped putting out music. I've consistently been putting stuff out since 96. And I think it was kind of the, you know, you get a vibe from a lot of the industry. Well, not now, because I don't think that really exists anymore. That, you know, just ignore it and it'll go away. Just ignore it and it'll go away. And that's kind of what it felt like to me for a while. And I was like, I'm kind of not going to go away. So you're going to have to deal with me. And I guess I wanted a career with longevity. You know, that's what mattered most to me. And it's not even... I've heard, you know, you're lucky. And I'm like, no, I'm not lucky. Like, I'm doing my best to progress.
Yeah.
And with Killscreen, I knew I wanted to, especially with You and Me being the last song out.
Yeah.
And, you know, definitely being a lot softer and about relationships. And I was like, you know what, I haven't blacked out on a song in a second. Yeah. So let me do something where I black out. And I was happy with it. There's a lot of shit that I'm writing now that... I don't stop myself from going that far with references.
Yeah, I was
and say, also because you guys exist,
well.
So that helps a lot.
Nice. Yeah, I was going to say, for not that you've particularly ever been one for you know, compromises or anything like that, but Killscreen in particular is like a super uncompromising song.
I think my level of dumbed down is now what people think it should be, and I just didn't want to do it anymore. And I was like, let me do stuff that makes me absolutely happy, where I can look back on it and be like, that was a fucking good line. That was really good.
Yeah.
You know, I want to like my own shit. I want my music to be music that I would listen to.
Yeah. It seems like something, I don't know if it's, you know, like you said, sort of the fading of the industry or what, but it seems like there's that attitude seems to be going around. Like when I heard, you know, Pharoah's upcoming stuff, it's very uncompromising in that way. It's very like, he's like, I love King Crimson and Pink Floyd, and I'm going to make shit that, you know, has that influence.
Exactly.
And I don't care if it's hip hop or not. So the last time we talked, you mentioned the Cake or Death record was about choosing to be a superhero, about going through your trials, but at the end of the day, deciding to still help others.
Yeah.
And now in this, the Gotham Down project, right, you did that interview with MTV and you talked about how, like, it's about a superhero, presumably the same character, turned villainous.
Yes.
So I was wondering both, like, as a you as a writer and the character in the album sort of go from one to the other.
The Cake or Death and Gotham are interesting stories because I'm you know, definitely playing around with time.
Right.
And so... Cake kind of starts around, I'd say, 2007 and goes to about 2012. And then Gotham Down kind of, starts around 2012, 2013, but, you know, has the ability to jump around as well. So, you know, the full story of superhero turned supervillain, and you know, it's going to be explained in a lot of videos, and I think that's a lot of it too. I've been kind of wary of people being like, I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about video wise, and let's not do that. Or I've handed in ideas, you know, and gotten back this is the version of the treatment that we want to do. I'm like, you know, that's the third grade version of what I want to do if that's cool to you. And with this, I really wanted to, I wanted to tell it like a movie, like a, or a comic book.
Yeah.
And, you know, with lots of great Easter eggs in it, and for people who are really fans who get stuff and listen to stuff, I want to reward them, because I think that's fair. And the idea of, you know, the battle of good and evil, that's every good story. Yeah. And I always said if I was, I think the closest superhero I could think of being was Dr. Manhattan.
Wow.
Which is kind of the, I want to save the world, but I don't know, you guys are kind of like, oh, now you want me here? Oh, okay.
Right.
You only call on me when they're going to destroy, like, the universe? No, you know what? Fuck y'all, I'm out. And then ultimately being like, I don't know, I don't even know if I'm helping you guys for the sake of you guys or for the sake of myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's always an interesting twist.
You said something about time in that last answer. Nice. And you'd said in that MTV interview, you said, I think all of our past, present, and future spaces are all intertwined, all folded to each other. If you can change your future, it changes your past. And I know that's been a big idea for you lately. I was hoping you'd talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm definitely a firm believer that, you know, space and time are all... I think we have the freedom to move around in them. Not this guy. No, because he would be doing that. I think the idea of if you change your future, you can change your... You are changing your past at the same time. Just in general, you know, if I do something that I wasn't going to do in 2014, in 2016, that has now become my past. You know, and I think it's all kind of the same things, and you can really, really decide what path you want to take, and it's never too late, because there isn't a too late to actually decide to do something else. And whatever you're doing affects how you tell your story from there.
Okay. So this
and time machines.
Right, and time machines, of course. Right.
I mean, that would be the easier answer, but
right.
So the, trying to sound cool.
The song has this theme of mystical creatures, right? You have the Leviathan, Phoenix, vampires, Kesha.
Let me tell you, when I Kesha, the Kesha line, I laughed for like 5 minutes because I was like, I can't fucking quote Kesha. What? And I was like, you know what? Yeah, I can. It's hilarious. Who else is going to quote Kesha? Nobody. Not even Kesha.
Yeah. So what is
Kesha,
it about
Kesha, why don't you quote yourself, Kesha?
Yeah. What is it about the imaginary creatures Kesha maybe included or not?
Possibly. That... With the glitter. Glitter,
right.
Kesha.
Right.
Not like cleaned up Kesha.
Right.
Because...
Who may or may not exist. We're not sure.
No.
Yeah.
Only seen that like once.
Yeah.
It's my only nod that I pay to the... female MC thing, you know, which is a wow, you're so much better than like an almost, you're almost better than some guys. I'm like, that is crazy. How could that exist? So, you know, my joke has always been to either refer to myself as a unicorn or the Loch Ness monster. So it's always kind of my play on that.
Okay. Awesome. And you used one of my favorite words ever in the song, which I was really happy to hear, that I always think is really funny. And I was hoping you could just talk about it. It's the term mollywop.
Mollywop is just a fucking great term.
Yeah.
And I've been wanting to use it in a song for a long time. I've also been wanting to mollywop a few people, but I figured just using it in a song probably is the better way to go.
Right.
And... I only remembered that I wanted to use it because I watched this great video. these polyglots. These two guys who have learned at home, just home training, have learned all these languages. And the way that they learn to, they call it leveling up. Mm-hmm. They go to these malls and just anywhere. I think they were in like Ohio or mm-hmm. something. And they walk around, like, say, a food court or just a mall or everywhere, and they talk to people and ask people where they're from and then start speaking their language because that's the best way to practice. And it's great. It's a white guy and a black guy, and nobody ever expects them to do what they're doing. And it inspired me so much. I was like, why? See, I'm not doing enough with my life. I could be learning other languages. These guys have endless, endless books at home, and... So the term polyglot, I was like, what am I going to rhyme with? And I was like, fucking mollywop. And I was like, it would make so much, it would make me so happy if those two guys were actually also able to beat the shit out of you. Because that's the only thing that would make them better. And that's kind of where that term came from. And yeah. But mollywop,
nice.
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And great. Also, it's up there with fisticuffs. Like, I always wanted to say that in a fight.
So, since you're playing a video game, seems like a good time to ask you. More than once in the song, you talk about this idea of death happening when you run out of time. Obviously, pretty closely related to, you know, video Mother. Games. Right? Mm-hmm. What about that idea resonates with you?
I like... I guess, you know, going back to the time thing, I don't think that, you know, I'm a definite believer in, you know, infinite consciousness, I guess. And, you know, that the physical body goes and that's going to stop and maybe I won't be able to sit here playing video games and that's fine because I don't really want to be physically immortal. That would kind of suck. I don't want to be around for all the other stuff. And I think that a lot of people really place a huge burden on themselves with, I need to get this done, I need to get this done, or, you know, none of that's going to be possible because you all got to go sometime. I'm like, yeah, but, I mean, I just don't understand. If you really understand the fact that we all actually are just made of energy and it's something that can't be destroyed, then there is kind of no running out of time. And for me also, it's been a dual idea of the career thing. Like, you know, people being like, "You're this is not, it's too late for you. If you only have this certain window and that's it." And I just don't believe that at all.
Awesome. And in this song, you reminisce about a sort of older, tougher, pre-Giuliani New York City. What do you think has been lost in today's sort of Giuliani, post-Giuliani, you know, even Bloomberg, tourist-friendly city? And what do you miss about the sort of more dangerous era?
You know, as a... New York and New Yorker, I stuff that we shouldn't miss, I probably miss. And then just a lot of things that I generally miss, I guess, from Manhattan. I'd say more so than even places like Brooklyn, which I think actually have a lot of neighborhoods that are building a great sense of community. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of places in Manhattan have really lost that. And, you know, it turns to anything, not necessarily referring to gentrification, but I think, you know, it was a bunch of people moving here and being like, I love New York because it's wonderful and there's all these boutiques and they're great and everybody's got, oh, fuck that, look at that. And it's just wonderful and it's got a vibe and it's so eclectic. Mm-hmm. Let's put a mall here. And for us... Growing up, malls were on TV. You know, there was no... It's malls are still fascinating to me. For those of us who, I guess, grew up in the city. And, I think it's not understanding how to appreciate something, even for the harshness, the beauty in the harshness of it. And, you know, not that I want everybody to be running around in 1980s New York, because fuck that, it was fucking terrible.
Sure.
But I think there are some really beautiful things that we're missing now.
Well, yeah, I'd imagine Chelsea was probably pretty different.
Chelsea was a lot different. Very, very different. You know, big artist community. And yeah, it was really interesting living in a place that was one of the first areas kind of like that to really, really get gentrified super, super quickly.
Yeah.
What always made me happy about that was still the inclusion of places like the Chelsea
right.
Hotel. And I think, again, it's people just who come into a city and come into a place and just have zero respect for any of the history of it.
Right.
And that's sad to me.
All right. Well, I think that's about it. Thank you for, you know, answering while tearing yourself away from Donkey Kong.
We're in. Let's just do this now.
All right.
This is what happens now.
You've been listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Rap Genius is dedicated to decoding, annotating, and analyzing hip-hop lyrics. Join us next week when we talk to legendary producer and the man behind the mad rapper, Derek D. Angeletti. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is hosted and written by Sean Sotero, a.k.a. Same Old Sean. To make sure you never miss an episode of the show, please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can reach me with your thoughts about Outside the Lines via Twitter. I'm at Same Old Sean. That's S-H-A-W-N. These interviews were recorded by Dan Berger. The show was engineered by Brian Penny at the beautiful Three Egg Studios in Brooklyn, New York. Our intern is Sunny Kahara. Intro and outro music by Psionic. Interlude music by Sir Loin. I'm your host, Same Old Sean, and I'll see you next week on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.